Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to have back Vijay Pandian in the studio with me today. Horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, regular contributor to the Green Bay Press Gazette as well, writes a column for them on gardening. And we're going to be talking about successful vegetable gardening today. We can look at some other things as well, certainly, but that's what we're going to start with. And we'll look at different ways you can control weeds. And he can answer pretty much any of your gardening questions. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or post a note or question on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Vijay Pandian, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
Well, when it comes to vegetable gardening, we already have callers online, by the way, and we'll get Larry and Jackie. We'll get to you in just a minute or two here, but let's talk about some different techniques when it comes to vegetable gardening. Some that may work better than others?
Well, the very first thing is that you have to figure out, you know, whether those crops are suitable for Wisconsin growing condition, actually.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. So depending on what part of the state of you are in, you know, some have a growing conditions of, you know, only 100 days, some have 110. And so in Green Bay area, you're pushing about 110, actually. Yeah. So make sure you select those varieties that's suitable for Wisconsin's growing conditions. And second of all, determine whether it's a cool season crop or a warm season crop. And always go by your soil temperature for cool season crop, because many cool season crops tend to take light frost very easily. So, but they do need to have a right soil temperature. So they need to have a minimum of 45 degree Fahrenheit to get started. So like your kohlrabi, cauliflower, broccoli, kale. I mean, right now, as of 2 days ago, I measured the soil temperature in Green Bay. It was at 3 inches, that was 55 degree, and 6 inches, it was at depth about 50 degrees. So it's good for planting cool season crops right now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, Larry in Iowa County has a question right about that. Maybe you've answered it for him. Larry?
I think he did. Thank you. Wondered if it was too late to put in the things like peas and spinach and lettuce and radishes and so on. And my other quick question is, because of the wet weather, I'm way behind in the tilling and everything, and I would like to put my potatoes out soon, but the only place I have ready is where the tomatoes were last year. And I know there's always a little warning about planting them right after each other. I just wonder how serious that concern is.
Well, that's a very good question, Larry. Potatoes and tomatoes are in the same family, and they kind of shared some similar diseases, actually. Say it's best to rotate them. Say it's not a good idea to plant, you know, potatoes where you planted tomatoes last year in the same spot. And you also brought a good point. If you are in a part of the state where the soil is still too wet, it's not a good idea to till it in. If you do till it in, your soil is going to be unfit for planting for the growing season. Say you may better want to wait actually for another few more days to let the soil dry. Now, one quick thing I will tell you is that do a simple test. It's called a soil ball test. You know, take a clump of soil and try to roll it in and try to form a ball. And when you gently tap it, if the ball crumbles, then it's good for tilling. And if you have a really wet soil, it'll stick in your palm and you'll have a hard time trying to roll it into a ball. Or if it's too dry, you cannot actually, you know, roll it at all. So use that test to determine whether it's good for, you know, tilling or not. And if it's too wet, delay your planting.
Yeah. Larry, are you going to plant any of those purple potatoes?
No, I don't have purple potatoes. Unfortunately, the ones that they sent me from Jones are beginning to sprout. And I'd like to get them in the ground.
Yeah.
There is another thing you can do, you know, if its ground is too wet, then probably, you know, if you have a section of your garden where you can build a raised beds, and, you know, you can go with like 4x6, 4x8, depending upon whatever the length is, about 12 inches deep, you know, if you want to build a raised beds, and potatoes allowed to grow in those kind of conditions, because in many parts of the state, we have a heavy clay type of soil, and so you have put a lot of organic matter into it to loosen up the soil to grow these kind of tuber crops. So, but in a raised bed, since you're going to put in a pre-mixed type of soil filled with a lot of compost, you know, and peat and some topsoil, so it's ideal for growing any tuber crops. So in that way, you can able to, you know, do an early head start in growing some of these cool season crop in those areas.
I grew some in a pot last year, in a huge pot. And I had really good luck with the potatoes that I had in there.
Absolutely. I've seen even some master gardeners been growing actually in a 5-gallon pail type of containers too. And they had some enormous success actually in growing potatoes. So pretty much, you know, you can grow, you know, potatoes in a any type of raised bed type of situation.
Yeah. Larry, thanks very much. Good luck. Appreciate the call. As long as we're on potatoes, you were telling me about a potato tower, which really sounded cool, and I thought, I should try that this year.
Well, one of my master gardeners told me this a week ago when I was tilling the garden bed at the old extension office, that he had a success in growing potato in a tower. He called it potato tower. So it's pretty much, you know, you have a wire mesh about 2 or 3 inches in wide, and you
so roll chicken it. Wire, what would we would call chicken wire, at least in my family.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, larger mesh, so that the wine could actually poke out of it, you know. And he rolled it actually like a cylinder, about 3 feet high, 2 feet in diameter. So for the first 12 inches, he put some dirt into it and put some fingerling potato tubers right in the middle of it, and then covered with a 6 to 8 inches of dirt on top of it. And again, another layer of fingerling potatoes in the middle, and a third layer of it. And then he watered it. So, and you have to fertilize it during the growing season too. So what happens is that, you know, by end of the growing season, when the vines start to wilt and die, you take off the chicken wire off, and the anterior column will be filled with a fingerling. If you just shake it up, it'll be dropping down with full of the potatoes, you know. So
I love that idea. And so the plant, the stems grow out the side and between the wire mesh.
Exactly. So the stems actually grows in air through the wire mesh, try to capture the light and air, and then produces the tubers inside, especially in the middle of those, you know, with the tower. So I'm going to experiment it too, because this has been told by a master gardener. He tried it last year. So, yeah.
So we'll give that a shot. Well, boy, we have a lot of callers. So let's just go back to the phones. Jackie and Eureka, your turn now. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I have a question that might go along with the topic today. I had to have a huge tree cut down that I thought was a walnut tree. Turned out to be butternut. And I'm wondering if I can have the smaller stuff made into wood chips and put it on my plants to mulch my plants, since butternut and walnut apparently have something in their wood to suppress.
Yeah, jugwort.
Yeah, I mean, butternut and black walnut, you know, have this kind of...
are the bad boys.
Yeah, the jugwort toxicity. Now, the thing is that both these trees, from the roots, bark, leaves, nuts, and the interior in a plant system has the jugwort. So even if you cut down the tree, made it as a wood chip, and you let the wood chip to dry, and you still put it in the landscape, it will still leach those jugwort. And say it's best not to do that, or not to put it in a compost pile either.
Right.
So, and, you know, you may want to actually, you know, stay away from the spot where you cut down the tree, you know, if you're going to put any future garden in that area. So.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there you go, Jackie. Thank you very much for calling. And butternut, I've kind of forgotten that butternut had jugwort as well.
Yeah, they're in the same, families and species. Yeah. So, yeah.
Becky and Ryo, your turn. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay. I have a large asparagus bed with a perennial garden next to it. In the last few years, I've got an infestation of field bindweed going in there, also known as, I called it wild morning glory. So I haven't kept up with keeping it out of there every year, and so it goes to seed. And I have been unsuccessful in keeping ahead of it. I thought it was growing from seed, but I discovered this spring it's got an extensive underground root system going. And
yeah.
That's why I think the weed preventer isn't helping, the seed, you know, weed seed preventer.
Yeah.
Any suggestions how I can deal with this?
Well, Becky, you're not the only one being unsuccessful in controlling the field bindweed in your asparagus patch. Field bindweed is a perennial weed. When you're dealing with a perennial weed, unfortunately, there is no selective herbicides either in the organic or in synthetic herbicides available to control them. So, and your only options are a bit limited. One, you can try to hand pull them if you can. I know it's not that easy because they have an extensive root system, like you said, and they're tough to get out of the ground, actually. So maybe when the soil is slightly moist, maybe you can try to pull them up. Again, you know, you're going to break the root system, but it's still going to pop back again. But the only thing you can do, you can try to weaken the plant system. But depending upon how big of a patch, it could be a laborious work. The other option you can do, is in the fall time, and you have to be extremely careful. You know, if you're going to use Roundup and to control this field bindweed in the fall, you use the Roundup and you dab it actually on the leaf of the field bindweed. And make sure the field bindweed still has a green leaf. It didn't go to dormant period at the time. And in that way, the Roundup gets translocated into the root system. But you have to be very careful. So don't try to spray it. If you do spray it, it might try to drift to your asparagus patch and cause some damage to it. The other option you can do, you can try to suppress it by putting some mulch around to it. But that may hold only for a couple of weeks during the growing season, and it pops back again. So there is not much can be done. But you can try to weaken the plant as much as you can.
Does bindweed start ahead of asparagus? Do we see bindweed coming up in the spring ahead of asparagus?
Usually in a bindweed starts to emerge only in late spring, early summertime, because it's more of like a summer type of perennial plant. It's not an early spring.
So there's
spring.
Nothing you can do ahead of it then? No. Yeah. All right. There you go, Becky. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today as you're getting started in the gardening season. Larry Mueller here with my guest Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Lots of callers online, number 800-642-1234. Kayla in Milwaukee up next with a question. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My partner recently built me a raised bed that's about 14 feet by 8 feet and about 14 inches in depth.
Yeah,
we got about 5 cubic yards of a peat mix delivered to our house, and it's in the bed now, but unfortunately got put into the bed while it was quite wet. So I've been waiting for it to dry, but now it's drying, but it's become very, very hard and almost cracking, almost like desert-like, and I'm not sure, should I just till it now or... It seems pretty like impossible to do, manually.
Is it and you said it's dry. The soil itself now is dry, so you could work it if you wanted.
Well, certainly the top layer is dry, but it's very, very hard.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit. I think we've got the idea here, Vijay. What do you think?
Well, in a raised bed, if you're adding a topsoil, you need to make sure you have an equal amount of compost or peat, something that, so that you loosen up the topsoil. So generally, you need to have 1:1:1 ratio, which is compost, topsoil, and perlite. And these three ingredients, mix them up really well together and use it. In that way, you can able to get a loose, fluffy type of soil. Now, there is another option, number two, available. This is my preferred option of a soil recipe, you know, which is called a soilless media. So you go with a compost, peat, and perlite, again, with 1:1:1 ratio. And that media works really well. You don't have to till your garden raised bed at all, even in the springtime. So every year, if the beds start to sink, add a little more compost to it, and using a garden trowel, just flip it back into it.
Okay.
I've been doing this, using this recipe for the last 4 or 5 years, and I had a great success. I never have to use even a shovel or anything. So in the spring, with a garden trowel, just scratch the little top 1 to 2 inches, it works really well. The thing is that if you do add a topsoil to it, then the tendency of topsoil over the time is that it naturally settles down and gets compacted. So then in that case, you have to loosen up the topsoil by adding compost every time. So that's a bit drawback, and one of the drawback, you know, if you're using a topsoil.
So what were the three your favorites again?
It's just purely compost, peat, and perlite.
Compost, peat, and perlite. Now, could Kayla? Could she add some of that in and work it in?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you're gonna create like an option two if she already have in a topsoil in her bed. Then probably, or if just a purely peat, then she can add some compost and perlite back into it, and you know she can take some stuff out and you know replace it with some in a good proportion of you know compost and you know perlite back into it. The one thing about perlite is so with dust and finey, so make sure don't use it. Yeah. You know when it's windy. You know,
yeah.
One thing I tend to do is that in a, I would actually sprinkle it and water it immediately so that, you know, it keeps
doesn't
it
blow
down.
Away.
Yeah. And then I would put this peat and compost back and then flip it back again. So
there we go. Kayla, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Chris and Adams next. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Happy, beautiful weather.
Yeah.
Finally. The first thing I want to say, and this is just a little bit of a rant, is that Roundup is neither good for the pollinators or for people, and so people should think twice before using that. There are other ways to get rid of weeds. And I have an idea for potatoes, and I saw this on the internet. I haven't tried it yet, but what you do is you cut the bottom out of a bushel basket, and then you set it on the ground, and you fill it up with some really good organic potting mix, and then you stick your potatoes in there. And in the fall, all you have to do is pick it up by the handles, and everything falls out on the ground, and you don't have to dig one way or the other.
So that's kind of like the potato tower, only it's a bushel basket.
Yeah, and instead of that, you know, you can use a chicken wire, but I think the concept is the same.
So. That's a good idea. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Yeah, it's the same. Well, if you've got an old bushel basket that's, you know, not worth anything anymore, mm-hmm. Why not?
Definitely.
Give it a shot. Anna Lisa in Green Bay, your turn.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is my own local Brown County educator that's on the air today.
Yeah.
I have a question about, well, you said you were going to talk about weeds, and I guess any plant that's not where it's supposed to be is a weed. And I'm having a terrible time controlling Pachysandra. Is there some less labor-intensive way to control ground covers that get out of, you know, that just want to spread everywhere? I planted these on a slope because I thought it was hard to mow, but now it's taking over, it wants to take over everything else that I've planted in different areas.
Well, thank you, Anna. And I think this is the first time I'm hearing that Pachysandra, you know, is taking over the yard.
Yeah.
Because usually the Pachysandra is typically planted in a shaded, moist area as a more for a ground covers. You know, people who have tough time in growing lawns in shaded area, they use this Pachysandra as more of a, you know, as an alternative. Now, say one thing I would say, just verify to make sure it is really Pachysandra that you're dealing with, not any other type
yeah.
of, you know, ground covers like Lamium, those could get very aggressive. So make sure about that. But if you feel that it is really Pachysandra, then probably your option is, you know, one, you can try to, you know, mow them as low as possible. Either use a handheld weed mower and try to mow them down quite a bit. In that way, you weaken the plant system quite a bit, and that'll give up. So it may take about, you know, in a few months of repeated mowing, and that'll drain out the energy, and then by next year, they won't have enough energy to put forward any new leaf growth, and then they will actually start to decline. The second option is probably, you can also try, using either, vinegar or acetic acid as an organic option, but it doesn't do much good. It just burns the leaf and it may tend to come back again. But that's at least an option for organic people. But the third one is, again, using the traditional Roundup to, control them up. So, but make sure you verify it if it's really Pachycendra or something else.
Yeah, so you might want to drop a photo of the plant to UVJ, I suppose, at your office. You could take a look at it and tell.
Definitely. They can email, you can email your picture by going to our website, browncountyextension.org. You'll find our email ID and contact information there.
Does that spread by underground rhizomes?
It does, actually. It's a typical, plant that suckers out from the ground.
So you'd have to put some sort of barrier along that, along the area where you want to keep it out of.
Definitely. But I never seen Pachycendra being very aggressive.
Think it's
and it is also very picky about its location because it really likes in a moist, rich soil, in a shaded area, it does really well. So usually you find it underneath the trees in a shaded area quite a bit. But in a full sunny, slopy area, I'm not really sure about that. I never seen it personally in a full sunny, slopy area where it gets really dry. In those circumstances, Pachycendra doesn't flourish that really well.
So you might want to get some photos or take a sample in to the Brown County Extension office and have them take a look at it. And then they might have some other suggestions as well as to what to do. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Bill in Mauston next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I just had a comment regarding the previous caller's problem with the bindweed.
Yeah.
Growing in the asparagus, I find that using black plastic tarps is extremely effective at killing weeds, and I even use them to have all the seeds in the seed bank and the soil sprout and die so that I can grow hardneck garlic.
That's an excellent suggestion. It's called a stale seedbed method, where you, the black plastic mulch will let the seeds to germinate and then gets really cooked up inside because, it gets so hot, even about like 80, 90 degree inside furthermore, and it cooks up the plant, any seedlings there, and you're kind of depleting the seed bank. And, I'm glad to hear when you use those kind of black plastic mulch, it kind of smothers and prevents those bindweed. I've seen some scenarios sometimes if you do have any other perennial weeds like thistles, sometimes it can tear open the plastic mulch and can come through that. But, I think if you be very proactive and try to, nip them up at a very young stage, then absolutely, Bill, you're right. You can able to successfully, smother them quite a bit.
Yeah, like that idea. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the call. We have Dave in Menominee Falls next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Got two questions. Actually, I have three. First one is, and I didn't hear one of the previous callers in a discussion of Roundup because I was on hold with your people. The second question is about raised beds. I have raised beds that I put as a permeable cloth, landscape cloth, over my raised bed and then put, cut holes and put the plants in it. Seems to be okay. And then I put mulch on top just to keep it from blowing around. Seems to be okay, but not as stellar as things have gone in before. I planted pretty much tomatoes in the same spot all the time. I've tried to amend the soil and add things like purple cow fertilizer, stuff like that. And don't seem to have the output that I used to have. Those are my questions. I'll take them up there.
All right. Thanks for calling.
So, I tend not to put the landscape fabric on my raised beds at all, because the concept of a raised bed is that you have a pre-mixed soil media, and you know, and the planting spacing is a little bit tighter that too, and you're giving in a good head start for the vegetables to grow in those raised beds. So they are typically outcompete quite a bit of the weeds. I hardly find any weeds on a raised bed unless you know you bringing a contaminated soil media which is filled with some thistles or any other perennial weed. Then probably you know it may be worth to put up a black plastic mulch or landscape fabric on top of it. The problem is that in a raised bed, things get hot, get heated up pretty quickly. Say, because you had about 12 inches above the ground, it dries out very quickly. And when you put up a landscape fabric, a black plastic on top of it, trying to smother the weed, when you try to water it, sometimes the water doesn't percolate that very good enough actually into the media itself. So your plant is actually literally a little bit in of a stressful condition, and that could limit actually your plant growth. Plus, when you're trying to add some fertilizer on top of it, you know, by doing some side dressing during the middle of the growing season, the question comes about whether the fertilizer has fully leached in the soil or not because of the barrier that has been created by the landscape fabric. So my suggestion would be is just to, you know, rip those landscape fabric off, make sure, you know, you have a non-contaminated media with the weeds, and use a thin layer of wood chip mulch. You don't have to use any like a 6 inches or something like that. Use like, you know, like a rice hulk or maybe like a clean straw for mulching purpose so that you allow some aeration to get into it too.
Good points, yeah.
And that may do the trick. So
there we go. Thank you so much for that question. Amy emailed to say she's moving in mid-August and wonders what vegetables and herbs she could plant in containers so she could take them with her. Specifically, can she plant delicata squash? It's her favorite. By August, that squash should be... Well, go ahead, BJ.
So it depends upon how big of a container you're going to move, yeah. You know, to grow a squash plant or any other vegetables. Generally, if you're trying to grow any vegetables in a containers, you need to start with the large size containers if you're going to go with tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash, cucumbers, and things like that. You need to have a minimum at least a 5-gallon container with get about 12 inches deep, you know, into it. And say if you happen to have that, make sure to get more of a bush type of varieties or patio type of varieties that are more compact and dwarf, and that can have the root system contained within that container. And the soil media is also very critical. Usually use a potting media rather than a potting soil. Potting soil tend to be very bulky. So use a potting media. And if you could, then you can able to successfully transport them, you know, to a newer location. And it's always good to have some pots in the wheels so that it's easy to drag back and forth if your potting is a bit heavy. Now, especially if you use like, you know, terracotta pot, clay pots, you know, they don't only dry out pretty faster, but also very bulky too. Or even if you use like, you know, a concrete planter boxes and things like that, they're very heavy. Say, the type of the container also plays a key role, you know, especially when you transport them. Herbs tends to do really well. You know, you can use any kind of like a herb starting from basil, thyme, you know, all those things.
Pretty much
really
anything.
Do.
Yeah, on the herb side. There we go. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your garden question. Talking about all kinds of things, vegetables and weeds, and we haven't gotten any flowers yet, I don't think, but they might come as well. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to Patrick in Superior next. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I live south of Superior, and because of the oil refinery fire, I was told not to use my garden for a year. So I wanted to do a bucket garden, and I've never really done one before. Do I aerate the buckets, and how do I go about that?
Say, if you're going to do a bucket garden or in a make sure, you know, it's about a decent size, you know, about at least to have a 5-gallon type, you know, of container size. And it has sufficient drainage hole, at least about 2 to 3 minimum, you know, 3 or 4 drainage holes at the bottom of it. So, you know, one thing about the plant is that as long as you have, a container that can hold the soil and has enough drainage holes, you can be able to grow plants right up there. So your bucket garden is just something like similar. It's the same thing with the container one. The one thing I would also suggest actually is to, if you're going to set your bucket on a flat surface, you know, put some sort of like a pot feet underneath, or maybe like some sort of like a wooden stub underneath, okay, so that it's about 1 to 2 inches above the ground, so that the drainage hole is not being blocked by those in a concrete floor or whatever you're going to set in. And that should do the trick actually in growing your plants. Yeah. And make sure to select the right type of plant for those kind of bucket garden. You know, you cannot expect actually to grow an indeterminate varieties like Big Sack or Mortgage Lifter into those bucket garden, and for that you need a bigger size containers for those things. So try to choose something more of a patio type or bush type varieties, you know, for your containers.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck. And remember, they can dry out, so they need you need to
regular watering is needed, especially if it's hot and dry, maybe once or twice, you know, depending on what type of media you're going to use.
Yeah, there we go. Let's go to Terry in Stoughton next. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering, I've been hearing a couple comments about plastic mulch, and I'm just wondering what your guest thinks about, first of all, just all the emphasis on trying to reduce our plastic addiction, and maybe moving towards something like brown paper mulch, and if he knows of like a source where a person could get like big rolls of that to use in the garden.
Oh, okay.
That's an excellent suggestion too. I mean, well, you know, if you feel that, you know, you don't want to use a black plastic, you know, for environmental concerns, certainly you can also transition to, you know, more of a recyclable paper mulch too. I see that some companies like, you know, do offer these kind of like a long rolls of paper mulch for sale. So you may want to just Google up, and you may able to find it either Burpee or Johnny's, you know, they may do sell it online too. The thing about, you know, I haven't personally experimented by using this paper mulch, rolls of paper mulch. I don't know how much, you know, thickness it has to be able to contain these type of perennial weeds. But, you know, I'm kind of assuming it may hold at least for one season, which might be sufficient enough. But, you know, certainly you can check it online. And, you know, anything is possible. I tried Master Gardeners using not only the paper mulch, using a thick cardboard sheet actually.
Yeah.
So they
cardboard boxes.
Yeah, cardboard boxes, cardboard sheets. You can spread it around the plant actually, and then on top of it, you can either put some sort of like, you know, mulch on further on top of it to suppress the weeds. The only thing is that sometimes the perennial weeds can know actually where the light comes in, even if it's a tiny gap around the plant, they can sneak in and then reestablish them by themselves. In those cases, you can try to, you know, hand peel them up or nip them up, you know, somehow. Yeah. Say anything, you know. I'm big off it, you know, going with using some organic mulch in your garden. Say it takes some time and effort, and if you do have those things, yeah, go for it.
And if you subscribe to a newspaper, save up those newspapers. I used newspapers 1 year on my vegetable garden with really good results.
Definitely, you know, I've seen many people using it, you know, on their plants, like, you know, around the tomatoes and things, you know, to prevent those, you know, soil from splashing, you know, from, on the lower surface of the leaves. Certainly, you can use any of those black ink type of newspaper rather than the color in a newspaper. You don't want those inks to get leached into it. So definitely, you can also go, you know, with using some newspaper sheets, cardboard sheets, or even if you want to get in a big roll of those paper mulch, you know, you can also use those things.
There we go. Thanks very much for calling, Terry. Appreciate it. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Laura in Grand Marsh. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy this program. I have a mulch question also. I'm up in a forested area, and I only have one spot that I can actually get the light that I need for my tomato plants. And so I've been dealing with tomato wilt. Last year I tried to put cardboard on there, but I mustn't have gotten enough on there because I still had the wilt. Can I use old pine needles, or is that too acidity?
Okay. So you may want to clarify, you know, what type of wilt you're having, actually. Say you're talking about, you know, a verticillium wilt, fusarium wilt. There are a lot of those kind of wilts that affect the root system and collapse into a plant. Are you referring to some, you know, early blight or septorial leaf spot that affect the leaves and causing the plant to collapse? So you may want to clarify, because the treatment or remedy varies depending upon what type of pathogen you're dealing with. And many gardeners faces typically, you know, in a raised bed situation or in conventional garden, early blight and septorial leaf spot, and that typically, you know, by end of the growing season collapses plant. But, you know, last year, you know, we had rain literally once a week, you know, in the growing season, most of the growing season, you know, until in end of July, early August, it started to dry out. So we did have a lot of root rot issues going on in the state last year too. So if you're not sure, send a sample to our plant pathologist, Dr. Brian Huddleston, to get it tested to figure it out. Now, as far as going back and adding pine needles, it depends. So you may want to know what your existing soil pH looks like. If you are living in an area where your soil pH is close to neutral or slightly alkaline or even slightly acidic, there is no harm in adding this pine needle. Pine needles are excellent. And, you know, in terms of altering the pH, it is only negligible amount. Yeah. It does that. So it's good for organic matter, and it also, you know, won't impact that much. But if you're living in certain part of the state where it's extremely acidic with a pH of 4.5 and those kind of things, probably in those scenario, you don't want to add those things, you know, to further cause it.
And Laura said, you said it was heavily wooded. If the other thing is, if you've got black walnuts, trees that are part of that woods, that pretty much that's what happens with tomatoes. They'll grow and then they'll suddenly wilt and die.
Yeah, certainly it's possible. Say, if you're within about 50 feet within vicinity of the black walnut tree.
Or a butternut.
Then probably your likely chance that it could collapse the tomatoes, you know, or most of the vegetable plants, you know, right in the middle of the growing season.
You know, I never get that problem with, have that problem with straw bales with my tomatoes.
Mm.
I am always surprised. I never have a disease problem with those bales.
The beautiful thing about, you know, in the straw bales or even in a raised beds, in a, you're allowing more aeration around the plant. So that dramatically reduces the leaf wetness. And that helps in minimizing the disease pressure out of that. Now, the other thing many people make a common mistake is that they plant closely.
Yeah.
So if you're growing an indeterminate tomato, you need to have at least 3 feet spacing minimum, you know, from one tomato to another tomato plant. Many people, you know, go with only about one feet or 2 feet, and then probably end up with all kind of these diseases too. And, you know, caging also really helps. In a, people sometimes use those, you know, those peony cages and things. They don't hold much of those 6 feet tomatoes plants actually. So you need to build your own tomato cage. One of our master gardeners, he built his cage using, you know, reinforcement concrete mesh, and it works out really great for him. And we tried it in our experimental garden. It's amazing actually. It has about 4 to 6 inches in a wire mesh, and it's about like 5-6 feet tall. And, you know, it's about 2-3 feet in diameter, and you can use it. It's durable, it's stable, and it works amazingly well on many indeterminate varieties.
Thanks again for calling, Laura. Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today on the Ideas Network. On this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller with Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. And we have a lot of callers, so we'll go right back to our phones. Steve in Scandinavia, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Steve, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for accepting my call. I have kind of an unusual problem. I have a raspberry patch, pretty healthy patch, and I have some creeping Charlie that has kind of invaded the patch. But I've noticed that it actually keeps away the other weeds, and I'm wondering if it could be used as a ground cover within the plants to control other weeds rather than me worrying about pulling it all out, or if it is going to drain the raspberry plants of nutrients that it needs.
That's a good question. And first of all, Creeping Charlie is not a native species. It's an invasive. It's from Eurasia. It can get very aggressive. I'm a bit worried that the competition from an invasive plant like Creeping Charlie with your cultivated crop, how much impact it's going to have and how much it's going to reduce the yield and the vigor of the raspberries. So I'm a bit concerned about that. So I think probably I would recommend to find ways to get rid of the Creeping Charlie, around your raspberry patch. Maybe you can keep it at least about 3 feet away from the bed, but not too close to it.
Be able to mulch that, wouldn't you?
Definitely, you can try mid fall you can spray around to it because it's a perennial weed. You can do that. The mulching problem with many of these perennial weeds is that, depends upon what type of mulch you're using. If you're using regular wood chips and things, these Creeping Charlies won't be affected that much. They'll come back again. The other option you can try, like the previous callers has been said, using like black plastic mulch. I know it's in certain raspberry production areas, they use this black plastic mulch.
Oh, they do.
And they've been growing that just to keep those weeds off. Either you can use a landscape fabric or a black plastic mulch.
I'd say the black plastic mulch or black plastic as a way to control it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely going to smother it. Over time, when it starts veering out, it may tend to come back. So, be aggressive on it. Try to control it.
Let's turn to Robin in Zion, Illinois next. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
The lady that didn't want to use plastic for a mulch for her garden.
Yeah.
Large vegetable garden. Every year I use red rosin paper, which you can find anywhere they sell flooring in any of the big box stores. Comes in large rolls. Two layers of that with some mulch on top to keep it down. And by the end of by the next spring, it's gone.
And so what's it called again? It's red rosin paper, I think you said?
It's used under flooring.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now I've got you. And that works for you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So the water gets through and...
Yep, the water gets through. I put the rosin paper two layers down, cut holes in it, put my tomato plants in there.
There we go.
Cover it with straw or whatever you want to keep the paper down. No weeds all year, and then by next spring, it's pretty much gone.
All right.
You can buy it in large rolls, so.
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks for that. VJ, a comment?
I never used it, but I'm just kind of curious, does it have any chemical content into it? Is it, can it able to potentially leach into it? Those things we need to check into it, before you start using in your garden. A lot of these creative ideas are there. I encourage homeowners to verify those things to make sure, it's appropriate for your garden before you start using it.
Thanks again, Robin. Appreciate it. Whitney in Verona, your turn. Hi, Whitney.
Hi. I was calling because about 3 years ago, I planted 5 blueberry bushes, and I got rootstock, so they were pretty small. But over the course of several years, they've maybe grown 8 inches and produced less than a handful of blueberries. So I was wondering, I read on the UW Extension website that I should have plucked all the blossoms the first year to encourage growth. So is it too late to do that, or... is it just too late for these blueberries?
Have you had a soil test?
No. We put them in compost, and then we added the ammonia sulfate in a raised area.
Okay.
I think probably Larry is right. make sure to do a soil pH test first.
Blueberries, you need an acid soil.
Yeah, blueberries are very picky about their soil pH. They need a soil pH about 4.5 to 5.5 in that range to start growing. If not, you're going to see a lot of, you know, greenish yellow leaves, and then probably they'll be succumbed to winter burn injuries or winter injuries, and then start to die back. Now, generally, I don't recommend adding compost, you know, in the soil media, especially for growing blueberries, because the raw materials that you're going to use for compost in a should make sure that, you know, it doesn't produce any alkaline effect to it. But if you do have only pine needles and pine bark for composting, then yeah, it's okay. But many times people use kitchen scraps and things like that, or even like, you know, fall leaves for composting, they tend to increase your alkalinity in the soil. So I really think that you need to start by getting your soil pH test done and try to find a way to lower it down. We have if you're living naturally in an area where your soil is alkaline, where the pH tends to be about 7, then probably try them in growing in a trench or in a container by using a soilless media. So for a soilless media, the recipe is very simple. Use one pot with the pine bark, one pot with peat, one pot with perlite. Mix them all three ingredients together. Now, and then you add sprinkle some sulfur, elemental sulfur, and in the springtime, every spring, and then you plant your blueberry plant. And once in 2-3 weeks, beginning from mid-May till end of July, once in 2 or 3 weeks, use some miracid to drench around the plant, and you will start to see some growth. Now, removing the flowers goes, they recommend that only during in the very first year. The concept is that when the first year you're planting, you want to make sure that the roots get established rather than the fruit, because a fruit for a plant to produce a fruit, it needs a lot of energy. So that's why in the first year, you're trying to focus the plant mostly on the root development. So you're artificially nipping the flowers off so it can able to establish first. And then in second year, you can start harvesting them.
So 5 years later, you're probably too late on that, but you're not too late on, you can still acidify that soil. I think if you get a soil test, when you send in the sample, you just say, I want to grow blueberries in this soil, and they will be able to tell you, all right, this is too not acid enough. You're going to have to apply X amount of whatever to handle this so that the blueberries will grow. So if you specify that in your soil test, they'll be giving you some really direct recommendations based on your own soil.
Definitely. If you send a soil sample through the extension, they will process it through the UW Marshville lab, and they'll send you a test result back again with a report telling you how much amount of sulfur needs to be added to acidify your soil. Now, again, one thing you need to be aware of, if you have a slightly acidic soil, let's say your pH is 6.5, 6.8, then you're fine with it by using some sulfur directly. But if you're something above 7, even if you add sulfur for 8-9 years, it won't be able to drop down quite a bit. So you need to drop your pH from 7 to 5.5. That's a lot. pH, even a 0.1 digit matters a lot. So one of our master gardeners did some elemental sulfur application around their birch tree for 8 years to bring it, actually, the pH down to slightly acidic. She had originally 7.3. After 8 years, she was able to drop her pH to 7.1.
Oh!
And that, too, she was very sincere in applying the elemental sulfur every year in the springtime. So now you can imagine or how tough it is to grow a blueberry in an alkaline soil. That's why, if you're still adamant about it growing, then I would scoop the plant out and create a soilless media, either in a trench or in containers. You plant them in there.
And again, the recipe that you had
is pine bark, peat, and perlite, and then sprinkle some sulfur, and then every once in 2 to 3 weeks from mid-May to mid-July, use miracid to drench around the base of the plant. Don't use miracid to spray on the foliage. It'll burn it.
Okay. You got all that, Whitney?
I do. And you think it's not too late to scoop them up now and do that?
Sooner the better.
Okay. Nice.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Vijay Pandian, our guest today here on the Ideas Network. If your blueberries died in a raised bed over winter,
if the plant is already stressed out and if it's growing in a raised bed, that's a lot of chances, you know, it could also be died because of the winter too. Because in a raised bed, the roots of the blueberries tend to dry out very quickly. So you have to constantly, you know, moisten the soil to stay, you know, cool and fresh. If the homeowner doesn't do a good job in that, it's going to get really stressed out in the winter. And last winter, we had a pretty dry winter. That's also put up further stress on the plant, and it could naturally collapse down.
Vijay Pandian, our guest today. He is the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Comes by every few months to talk with us about what's going on in the garden here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. What gardening questions do you have? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We would love to hear from you. We hear a lot about companion planting, and when we're thinking about vegetables in the garden, talk a bit about companion planting and the vegetables that can be companions.
I say, you know, certain plants have some natural ally, and those are plants are called companion plants. And so, you know, our Native Americans have used it. You know, the classic example is the Three Sisters Garden, where the plant, you know, you plant the corn, beans, and squash, you know. So they kind of help each other out, you know, and trying to grow them. But certain plants, you know, besides being friendly, they can also deter certain pathogens and certain insect populations too. So you all heard about, you know, using some marigolds and those kind of plants, you know, around them. So those are all, you know, an excellent one for trapping some of those, you know, soil-based nematodes. You know, if you have a situation where, you know, your nematode populations are so high and affecting your, you know, your tuber crops, then probably having those kind of marigold type of plants might also helpful too. Certain other plants can be used as a trap crop. So basically, what that means is that, like, you know, if you have like a cabbage, cauliflower, they tend to attract quite a bit of this diamond black moth type of insect.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, destroy your leaves, you know, make all these holes and weaken your plant system. So what you can do around your perimeter of your garden, you can dedicate certain section of, your cabbage or cauliflower plant right up there, and you can attract all those things, you know, to go and attack that, and then you can still able to rescue some of your other main crop in your main garden area too. So you're basically using the plant as a bait, actually, you know, trying to allure the, you know, the insects to come and attack here rather than this one. So the companion planting system works on certain crops and certain other crops, you know, it may not work that really well. So you have to personally experiment by yourself. You know, I know there are certain, you know, publications available, you know, either through Nebraska, Minnesota, they do have some, even from Cornell University, they do have those kind of publications, what plant works very well, you know, for the main crop. So you may want to experiment it by yourself again in your garden to figure it out.
Patty in Waupaca wondered how to get rid of Creeping Charlie in a small yard in the city. And we don't know really, I know it's a small yard. It may well be a yard that is shaded, which is probably why she has the Creeping Charlie in the first place. It's a small yard. I'd be out there pulling the Creeping Charlie by hand, even though it's in a lawn. You can get rid of a lot of it, and then probably, depending, you know, somewhat would depend on the grass that's in there, because there are certain grasses that do better in shade than certainly Kentucky bluegrass.
Exactly. Say, you know, you have to look into this perspective like this. If you have a yard, you know, with the grass, and if the grass starts to decline, you need to figure out why the grass is declining down. Because grasses tend to be naturally aggressive in trying to repel any of the weeds naturally trying to invade into your yard. So if the grass declines, then the weeds take over it, and being more opportunistic, they'll start to flourish right up there. So try to figure out in this way why your grass failed to grow. Understand what's the necessary environmental condition the grasses need. So typically in a shaded area, you have a large trees or maybe a building might be shading in. So in those cases, you know, make sure that, you know, you don't use Kentucky bluegrass. Kentucky bluegrass needs full sun. So if it's a more of a dry shaded area, go with a fine fescue species. You know, 50% or more with the fine fescue species mix, go ahead and shade it. Or you can go with the anterior area with tall fescue too. They can also take shade too. But don't blend the tall fescue with any other grass species. It'll give you a bicolor look to it and it may not look aesthetic pleasing. Now, that should be your long-term strategy in trying to, you know, repel any of the weeds. Now, in going back to a short-term remedy in trying to control the weeds, you hit right on the nail. If a small-sized yard, your best option is to hand pull it. So when the ground is moist, many of the perennial plants can come up very easily, and you can bag them up and you can trash it. But you know, if you feel that to me hand pulling is too much, you know, maybe I'm not physically capable, or it's I don't have ways to do that. Then in that case, depending upon the extent of this invasion in your backyard, your management options varies. Now, for organic people, that is a new one called chelated iron. And this chelated iron is an organic, it's called a reduced risk type of product. You can use that. And after a few applications, you can able to successfully control them. It may take, 3 or 4 applications in a season to knock them out. Now, if you're not an organic... Chelated iron. Now, it's been in the market in the last few years, and it can be used to control any of the broadleaf weeds, in the yard. Now, the other option is, you can go with, if you're non-organic people, then probably you can go with conventional Roundup and you can spray for it. Now, whatever the method you try, after you remove this weed, reseed it back again. Either do a top dressing and sprinkle some seeds and make sure to choose the right seed mix and flip the seeds back into the soil at about 1/8 of an inch and water it. Don't let the soil to sit bad. If it does happen, then probably the Creeping Charlie will be back
come
again
right back.
And to do it. It may take at least 2 or 3 season, actually, to rigorously, to control these Creeping Charlie.
What are there some new varieties, vegetable varieties on the market before we go back to the phones here? Again, you can call in 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. But are there some new vegetable or newer vegetable varieties that you are looking forward to trying out?
Well, there are some, few tomato varieties that I like to experiment this year in our test garden. And I've been shopping in the 2 days ago with the local greenhouse growers and see what they've been carrying on. Nothing so brand new, but I want to go with one of the Stupici tomatoes I would like to try this year. And I heard from one of the growers that during a presentation at the Master Gardeners that he loved this variety, Stupici. It's really good.
Is it a big slice here?
Slicing tomatoes, you know. I want to experiment this year on that. And there are a lot of, all-American selection winners, too. One of them I was looking, actually, is the one called, the pink tomato. It's really pink in color, and it was an AAS winner in 2015. So I would like to try that one and see how it works. see if it's really tastes good or not. That's one thing I would like to try. And there are a few other oddities that I like to try to. I always like this ground cherry, I would like to try one called the, with the Master Gardeners, they've been trying this Angimama or something, and I just want to experiment that.
Aunt Jemima.
Aunt Jemima, yeah. I used to call Aunt Angimama. And it's a really nice, it's like a candy, actually, In the fall, you harvest them, and when the pod turns brown, the papery pod, and, you can, use that. That's a really a nice one to try.
So. Very good. We have many callers again, so we'll go back to the phones. Al and Kakana up next. Hi, Al.
Hi, Larry and guest. The question I have is this. I have a large hibiscus plant, and it's like the shrub, and I've had it 5 years, and I cut it back every year, and it grows back just fine. Then I've got a whole bunch of small ones that we bought that are like the minis, and I didn't cut them back in the fall. I cut them back about a week or so ago, and I'm worried that they don't look like they're getting any green on them at all, that they're going to die on me. My wife is going to kill me for doing that. So my question is, is it too soon for them to come back, or did I kill them and I'm going to have to go replace it all?
Okay. That's a good question. One thing about hibiscus, hardy hibiscus, you have to be patient. They are the last one to pop out of the ground. So I've seen even like in early June, they tend to come back. So depending upon how warm the soil is, and the air temperature is, it takes time. So be patient. Now, being said that, we had an interesting winter. We didn't have enough snow cover in our area for quite a bit of time, in the winter time. And depending upon, sometimes if we don't have enough snow cover, then probably that's a chance that the crown may also got killed, especially if you planted it very recently in the last 1 year or something like that. They might be still struggling to establish in the new environment. So that could be an added-on stress. Say, right now, just be patient. You will start to see them, popping back again. If the crown is still alive, it'll come back. Probably in early June, it'll start to come back. But in future, if you still are planting some new hardy hibiscus, make sure in fall mulch it. Put up about like 6 to 8 inches of heavy mulch and wrap around with some chicken wire around to it. So in that way, you can able to protect these hardy hibiscus. I've seen hardy hibiscus, which at the old extension office, that one of our former master gardener, Bob Margin, tried it. His famous one was Lord Baltimore and Lady Baltimore variety. He raves about it very much, and it's a showstopper. And it has this bright red, like a dinner plate size type in a hibiscus flower. Blooms in about like in July, early August. Now, I've seen it watching growing for 5 years in a row. And then all of a sudden, 6-7 years, it disappears. And I think probably either the winter could have killed it or something like that. And I've seen the same kind of scenario happen at our botanical garden too. So it's not like depending on the winter, I think it may get some winter kill in possible, and that could also collapse the plant too. So it's not like a truly hardy type of perennial for Northeast Wisconsin area.
There you go, Al. So stay patient, keep watching, and see what happens. Thank you. Don in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi, love the show. Thanks very much. Here's the question. I've grown potatoes. The first time I grew them, they looked like they came right out of the store. Subsequent attempts, the potatoes are fine, but the skins are terrible. Am I doing something wrong? Is there a soil problem or something that I need to add?
Are they scabby or what are they? What are the
scabby?
Scabby.
Yeah, the potatoes tend to, if you grow potatoes in the same site location year after year after year, they tend to get the scab disease actually right up there. So in those kind of scenarios, do a crop rotation. Rather than planting the same spot, you know, move it to a different location. You know, ideally, potatoes need a slightly acidic soil. So maybe think about, you know, trying to acidify your soil a little bit by using some sulfur a year before itself, and then you plant your tubers in the following spring. So, but for now this year, at least, you know, try to do change your garden from one spot to another spot, you know, move your potato, you know, plantings to another spot in the garden and try it out. And maybe, you know, in the growing season, sprinkle some sulfur, but, you know, tend to do it every spring, you know, add some sulfur.
There we go. Thanks very much for calling. And on to Hal in Bayside. Hi, Hal.
Hi. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last year, I was growing California Wonder green peppers, and when I planted them, they were about 6 inches tall. And through the entire summer, they grew maybe another 4 inches, and I only got a couple of small green peppers off of them. They didn't grow. What do you suppose the problem was, and what should I do this year? Thank you.
Well, peppers are a bit iffy. It depends upon a lot on the growing conditions that we have. Now, they tend to like in a warm weather, hot, dry conditions for them to grow really well. So first of all, make sure you have your peppers in a full sunny area. It needs to have 8 hours of full sun. Make sure on that. Second of all, you know, make sure your soil has good enough organic matter, so it's loose enough. And third of all, you know, it's best to let the peppers to grow in a raised bed so it gets warmed up very quickly rather than in a conventional rototill type of garden. So that could be another one. And don't try to fertilize your pepper pan quite often. If you tend to boost it quite often with once a week or once in every 2 week with some, you know, liquid fertilizer, you tend to boost the leaf growth, not the fruit. And make sure, you know, to plant them, you know, at the right timing. So generally, you know, if you delayed your planting to about mid to late June, and then
you're
probably
gonna get better results.
You're going to get only immature peppers, you know, not like that. So make sure to plant them like end of May or first week in June, depending upon what part of the state you're in, to get those pepper transplants, have a good start.
But you want to make sure that you're planting after you're sure that you're not going to get extremely cold temperatures, because peppers hate.
Oh, yeah. So if your night temperature drops down to 55 or less than that, then probably they will be very stunted in appearance. They won't produce any leafy growth. You will start to see the leaves turning a little purplish in color, actually, too. So that's a good indication that, okay, the night temperature seems to be a bit cold. So in those cases, you want to put some, you know, floating row cover, or maybe, you know, your milk cart and jug or something above on top of it to protect it from that. Say, in a watch out for the night temperature and watch out for the soil temperature too. So peppers do need a warm soil, about 60-65, you know, generally for planting.
So it's too early to plant peppers even at this point in a good share of Wisconsin.
It's much. I think, as I said, 2 days ago when I checked the soil in the Green Bay area, it was 55 degree. It's suitable for cool season crop. I think still needs to, you know, we need our soil to be warmed up. Then again, that's why the raised beds comes in very helpful.
Yeah.
But again, you need to watch out for the yard temperature, and the night temperature especially, you know, shouldn't drop below 55.
Thanks, Hal, for calling. Jill in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thanks. I have, I guess, two questions. Well, they're related. But last year and the year before, we planted hops. So we have some hop vines that are 2 years old and some that are 1 year old. And out of maybe 12 or 14 that came up last year, only two have come up this year. Now, we've planted them in boxes rather than in the ground. And so we're wondering, my mother-in-law's theory is that we had such a cold winter without the snow cover on top that maybe would have given some insulation. And we're wondering if maybe they just died off. The same thing happened with our rhubarb. We had two rhubarb plants, and every year they both come up, and this year only one of them came up. So we're wondering if that has to do with cold weather and lack of snow.
Absolutely, Jill. You know, that's my primary suspicion is going to be. I've seen many landscapers, they lost some of their ornamental plants to the winter injuries. They've been growing them in a container settings, and they even moved those container type of ornamental plants inside the hoop house, and still they got quite a bit of winter injuries where the roots get froze and then they collapse down. So if you look in the part of this past winter, we have no snow cover absolutely until when we recently had our early spring snow shower. So it was relatively dry, and the night temperatures even dropped down below, 30 degrees quite often. And so it's likely possible that the roots could have been frozen to death. And I think I would wait till about early June before you make any addition to rip them up. So just in case, to pray for some luck,
But you're probably going to have to plant anew if you want some more hops.
Yeah, definitely. And, I think one of the lessons that you might have learned is that maybe not to experiment by growing this perennial plant in a raised bed. Maybe it's best to plant them in the ground. And the one thing about when you're planting in the ground, make sure the soil is well loose and drained, because hops are also very sensitive to wet soil. So if you have too much, wet soil in that area or low-lying area, then you may want to avoid that.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck with those hops. And tell you what, Dawn has a question about growing roses. Do you have a quick question, Dawn?
Yeah, I do. I just planted some roses, and I left the union bud above the soil. And I've always done that, but we haven't had, the snow and all that. So I was just wondering, would it be okay to leave them like that till fall, and when I winterize them, mound on a couple, 3 inches of soil?
Absolutely, Dawn. I mean, when you have a hybrid tea roses like those things, you really need to mound it in late fall. So right around early to mid-November, depending on where you're living, right around mid to late fall, that's the time you need to start overwintering your roses. And not 2 to 3 inches. In fact, I would actually mount first actually about 6 to 8 inches of dirt. Take a garden soil and mount it. And then further on top of it, I would put some extra fall leaves and any other type of organic mulch on further top of it, and wrap around with some chicken wire. And then you can also cut the cane back to about 3 to 4 feet tall and then tie them together.
And with that, we are out of time. Vijay, thank you so much for being with us today. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, and we will have him back and do it again. Monday, we have our physical therapist back, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. They'll be talking about hip and knee osteoarthritis. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.